This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of May, and this week we learned that the U.S. lost over 20 million jobs in April. As of mid-April, in fact, that's what the monthly jobs reports measure. The job situation is mid-month. So we know we've lost millions more jobs since then, as companies severely disrupted by the coronavirus epidemic lay off workers and, in some cases, close down for good. Later on today's show, former top Obama economic advisor Gene Sperling will join us to talk about what this crisis is teaching us about jobs and economic dignity, and we'll discuss when and how America can go back to work. But now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Christine Emba of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Josh.
I want to start today's show by talking about Michael Flynn, the president's former national security advisor who had pleaded guilty to making false statements to federal investigators. His case had been a saga, with Flynn protesting in the courts and in the press that he was railroaded. He was having little success in getting a federal judge to look past his repeated admissions of guilt, and he seemed to be looking for a presidential pardon. But Flynn had not been sentenced yet, and with the Justice Department now saying it wants to dismiss the charge against him, it looks like a pardon probably won't be necessary. To talk about this, I want to bring in Ken White. Ken is my co-host on our spin-off show, All the President's Lawyers. He's a former federal prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So, Ken, how did the Justice Department explain this decision to seek dismissal of this charge that the defendant had already pleaded guilty to?
Well, they did it in a few ways. The primary way they did it was to say that Flynn's lies were not material, meaning that they did not matter to any pending investigation. Now, materiality is an element of lying to the government under 1001, the section of the law that criminalizes lying to the feds. But what's very notable about this is that it's a dramatic departure from what the government normally argues about materiality. Normally, the government's position is, if this is the sort of information that could conceivably influence an investigation, it's material. The Justice Department's decision here to call this not material on a theory that perhaps there wasn't a legitimate investigation is completely different than any argument the Justice Department has ever made about materiality in any other circumstance.
So, Rich, do you think this was a justified decision? I think what Ken's getting at there is that you could have a policy dispute about whether the thing that Flynn did should have been illegal or should have been charged, but it is illegal. It's routinely charged. And so this looks like the Justice Department making one set of rules for a close associate of the president's as compared to a set of rules that exists for everybody else.
Well, I don't think there was any predicate for the investigation in the first place. It was manifestly absurd. I mean, the illegality, allegedly, of Flynn talking to the Russian ambassador prior to taking his job as national security advisor would have been a violation of the Logan Act, something that's never prosecuted. I think the last time it was attempted was in the 1850s, constitutionally dubious law. So that's crazy. And the idea that Flynn talking to the Russian ambassador prior to becoming national security advisor somehow implicated some conspiracy or showed he might be a Russian agent is also absurd. So they go and they do this ambush interview. James Comey has actually bragged in public about going around the procedures that you'd usually have for such an interview. Don't put Flynn on his guard. Flynn believes probably he's just having a conversation with another peer in government. And the FBI knows what's said in the conversations with Kislyak because they have the recordings. So what are they doing? And then there's a dispute over whether the agents actually thought Flynn lied or not. And the FBI does nothing with this as appropriately. And then 10 months later, Bob Mueller comes in and squeezes Flynn and gets him to plead guilty by threatening to prosecute his son. Flynn is under financial pressure, very likely, might be under other personal pressure we're not aware of. So this is just a travesty. And I think the Justice Department deserves credit for going back and undoing it.
Ken, do you think that's a fair characterization?
Not at all. None of that is true. And the bit about Flynn being ambushed is a description of tactics the FBI has always used, continues to use, and will still use after this dismissal. The proof here would be if you saw the Trump Justice Department creating any sort of new policies or standards that would govern how the FBI acts in interviews, that would say that there has to be a legitimate interview, legitimate investigation before you can charge charge 1001 that says that you can't try to trick people or coerce them, but they're not going to make those policy changes because this doesn't reflect policy. It reflects politics.
But wait a minute. You didn't address why they were investigating Flynn in the first place. What were they investigating for?
But that's the thing, Rich. Normally, that's not a question that gets asked, and that's not a defense that succeeds. The FBI gets to interview you for any reason whatsoever.
I mean, I'll say what the simple explanation seems to be here, which is that the FBI was in the middle of a large, intense, months-long counterintelligence investigation into ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. Mr. Flynn was an aide, a top aide to the Trump campaign, and then he lied about speaking to the Russian government. So it seems like there's a relationship there that perhaps the FBI would be legitimately investigating.
I mean, I would be thrilled.
They knew what the conversation was. They had it on tape. They had the transcripts of the conversation. This is the incoming national security advisor. Of course he's going to talk to foreign officials. So it takes some bizarre paranoid view of the world that it shows he might be a Russian agent or conspiring with the Russians. He's having conversations with a foreign official.
Michael Flynn was in fact an agent of the Turkish government. So why would it be far-fetched to think that he might be an agent of another government?
Because he's having a conversation with the Russian ambassador and he's the incoming national security advisor, he is under suspicion of being a Russian agent?
Well, he was a Turkish agent.
They'd investigate him for that and they found no disparaging information. They're on the verge of closing the case. And then they did this. And this is not how our system of justice should work. If you want to say Michael Flynn is a guy who showed very poor judgment, Trump never should have picked him as a national security advisor, I'm all with you. But to leap to that and to say the FBI should have done this interview, and then when the FBI agents don't even agree whether he lied or not, he should be squeezed over it and financially ruined over it. I think if you just consider what if this happened to the other side, that you might consider it differently. But this shouldn't have happened to Michael Flynn. It was just wrong.
I would be thrilled if those values were reflected in the future in the way investigations are conducted. But no one thinks they will be.
Can we talk about what's likely to happen going forward here, Ken? Because the Justice Department has made this motion to dismiss with prejudice this charge against Michael Flynn. And dismissal with prejudice would mean that not only is the charge dismissed, it can't be brought again. Will the judge necessarily comply with this motion? I mean, obviously, my understanding is generally prosecutors have a great deal of leeway over who will be prosecuted, what prosecutions are withdrawn. So should we assume that this is done? This means that the charge will in fact be withdrawn?
I think it's likely, but it's entirely possible that Judge Sullivan will dismiss it without prejudice, meaning hypothetically the charges could be brought up again.
Christine, is this, you know, should this be water under the bridge if there is a Biden administration, or would you expect to see the Department of Justice try to bring these charges again or bring other similar charges against officials from the Trump administration?
You know, I don't think that it should be water under the bridge because it's an example of how the Department of Justice has been completely undermined or will have been completely undermined by the prior administration. And a Joe Biden administration would do well to try and rebuild some of these pillars. I'm not sure that that would mean bringing these particular cases back to trial. There are so many shenanigans that have happened under the Trump administration, under William Barr, that to retest, relitigate all of them would take up the valuable time that a Biden administration would be using to fix all of the much larger mistakes that have been made in this administration. But I think that they would need to be addressed in some form.
I mean, Rich, doesn't the fact that you have an attorney general now who has been clearly much more willing than Attorney General Jeff Sessions was to put a thumb on the decisions about what are made in individual criminal cases, which has led to the withdrawal of many of the line attorneys who worked on the Flynn prosecution throughout the process. Doesn't that set a precedent for the next administration that, you know, you can go through and try to, you know, settle what the scores were from this administration? Because it's likely to be a target-rich environment. The president's campaign manager has gone to jail for extensive financial crimes, including tax evasion. It doesn't seem to have been a coincidence that the president ended up with many people like that surrounding him. And as I have noted with regard to Flynn, you had this whole area of Turkey-related activity for which he was never charged, but conceivably possibly he could be in the future.
And what Bill Barr is doing is going back and relitigating these cases and looking to see if there are abuses or excesses. And it's just obvious that there were. So I don't know what he's supposed to do. This was a Justice Department abuse driven by a crazy conspiracy theory that the entire, you know, half of the political spectrum of the country, much of the media of the country, bought into for 2 years. And it was a blind alley.
It wasn't a blind alley, though. It was, you know, the fact that, you know, the fact that the large, strong version of Russia collusion, which I never bought into, for the record, was never substantiated, doesn't mean that there weren't a substantial number of crimes committed along the way. I mean, with Paul Manafort being the best example of this. Paul Manafort was a career criminal.
Paul Manafort is basically the only example of it.
What we have is Flynn being interviewed by the FBI in the context of a Russian investigation, which, whether you believe that it was valid or true or not, is something that the FBI should have investigated and did. He had a constitutional right to remain silent, however much he was being squeezed, as you say. He didn't. He talked, and then he lied, and that lie came to light. I don't know why we're arguing that, like, he was railroaded. He could have just been quiet. He could have just told the truth. He didn't. Even the president said that he had to fire Flynn because he lied to the FBI and to the vice president. I don't know why we're trying to paint him as some innocent. He could have been an innocent person, but he chose not to be. Those are the facts.
Well, he was a high-level government official, and a high-level FBI official says, I want to come talk to you. Is he supposed to assume that this is an investigation of him? And every jot and tittle of what he said could be possibly used against him to ruin his life and throw him in jail. Why would he even know that or assume that? And how do you know he lied if the FBI agents who actually sat in the interview with him aren't sure he lied?
Well, Rich, you do know that that's what the FBI does, right? They come in and they put you off kilter and they try to get you to think that they're your friend. They do that every day. All law enforcement agents do that. And do you think that the government's going to stop saying that that's okay now?
Ken, in this particular instance, if you think this is a bad practice in general, you should think it's a bad practice in this case. It's your inconsistency. You're indicting yourself.
You're mischaracterizing me. I'm not fervent about prosecuting him. I think it's a bogus prosecution.
Okay, well, we agree then.
I think this type of 1001 is a bogus prosecution. I think that the hypocritical, bogus justifications are being given are transparent and a corruption of the Justice Department. We both know these arguments are not going to be brought to bear again for anyone's benefit. They're only being brought to bear for Flynn.
I take your point that if we put other such cases under a microscope, we might see similar abuses, but it doesn't make this any less abusive, as I think you just admitted.
Let's leave that there. Ken White, criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor, co-hosts All the President's Lawyers with me every Wednesday. Ken, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Josh.
I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Christine Emba of The Washington Post to talk about the terrible jobs report. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. The April jobs report was released on Friday, showing a loss of 20.5 million payroll jobs in the United States. The report had grim information about almost every part of the economy, though some parts were grimmer than others. About half of jobs in restaurants and bars are gone, over half of jobs in dental offices, 60% of jobs in clothing stores, casinos, amusement parks, recreation facilities. Other parts of the economy are more normal. Grocery employment is flat. Employment at banks is flat. General merchandise retailers like Walmart and Costco actually employed 5% more people in April than in March. The CARES Act massively enhanced unemployment benefits, adding $600,000 a week for 4 months and making benefits available to categories of workers who could not normally have gotten them, like freelancers. So that is helping to address this huge job loss that we're seeing in this report. Many states have been slow to get those unemployment checks out, but as they do get them out, they're replacing 100% or more of of income for most workers who make less than $50,000 a year. So that's helping people for now. But what's the outlook ahead as we look ahead to a slow and unsteady economic reopening with millions of workers still making initial claims for unemployment benefits every week? To talk about that, we're joined now by Gene Sperling. Gene was a chief national economic advisor to Presidents Clinton and Obama, and he's written a new book called Economic Dignity. Gene, hello. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
What do you see when you read this report?
I see an understatement of how bad it really is, because even though 14.7% is getting screaming headlines as the worst since the Great Depression, the way that they ask the question has led people to give answers in the unemployment survey that probably understated how bad it is. So I think when we finally get the right numbers, we're going to see that unemployment was really over 20%. And we've already seen in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania that you have nearly a quarter of the working population has filed for unemployment insurance. So I think we're at, you know, I don't think we've hit the bottom yet. I think the May report will be even worse. It's not going to say we lost 20 million jobs, but it will show millions of more jobs lost that we've already seen reported in the last couple of weeks. And I think we're going to see that we are actually truly at depression levels that we have not seen since 1931, 32, and 33.
To break out a little more what you mean by that when you talk about the 14.7% unemployment rate, the Labor Department conducts two surveys to look at the employment situation. They ask employers about who they employ, and then they also ask workers about what kind of work they're doing. And so what you're getting at there is when you figure out if someone's unemployed, the question isn't just whether they have a job or not. It also includes things like whether they're looking for a job right now. And so what you're suggesting is basically there are some people who don't have a job, but they're not looking for a job right now. For example, because the coronavirus has shut everything down. So some of those people may not be counted as unemployed, even though from a colloquial sense, we would think of those people as unemployed. They should be working and they're not working. And so that means that the employment situation is even worse than you would think from looking at a number like 14.7%.
That is exactly right. Because when they ask people, are you looking for a job? Even though, of course, they're really in the labor market and want it, they probably feel they should say no because they've been ordered to shelter in place. And in fact, the Labor Department actually suggested that their number might be 5% below what it would be. But, you know, in some ways, Josh, we kind of know the answer. We're getting these initial unemployment rates claims. They're at 33 million. This didn't count the last 7 million. So, you know, we know that we're in epic territory of 20 to 25% of our population not working. And it's also suggesting that some of the, you know, ideas that we had are not working. And you're right that the unemployment benefit has really helped a lot of people who could break through the phone lines because of that extra $600, which does give 100% job replacement for a lot of, wage replacement for a lot of people and help them pay their bills and stay in their home. But remember, we were also supposed to have this small business program that was supposed to give small businesses the money to keep people on the payroll and not have to lay them off. And that has been so miserably administered that it has gone to all of the people who really probably needed it the least, who had the best connections, who could get concierge service from their banks. And what you're seeing, as you said, when half of the, you know, some of the restaurant jobs are gone, you're seeing that a lot of those small businesses who might have kept the lights on, kept their workers on the payroll, did not get the help they want. And that is part of the reason these numbers are so much higher than they could have been, or that we're seeing in some European countries who do try to protect the payrolls of their small businesses.
Rich, it seems to me that there's sort of two phases of dealing with what everyone all across the political spectrum realizes is an economic calamity here. The first has to do with dealing with the part of this crisis where huge numbers of people are necessarily unemployed. And so you have those unemployment benefits, you have the PPP program that Gene was referencing there. The idea of behind that program was supposed to be to pay small businesses to keep their workers on the payroll. That program has hit a lot of pickups, basically getting money to people while they're not working so that they're not destitute and so that there's enough money out there in the economy so that when it makes sense for people to shop and consume again, they'll have the money to do it. Then the second phase has to do with getting people back to work. And it feels to me like the conversation has really already shifted toward that second phase, maybe prematurely, especially for certain parts of the country. And so am I characterizing this correctly, Rich, when I say, you know, what we're hearing a lot from Republicans right now is we need to get people back to work. We need to find ways to reopen the economy. We need to indemnify firms against lawsuits so that they're not afraid to reopen. We need to restrict who exactly can get unemployment benefits so that people, when their old jobs become available, they have to actually go back and take those jobs because we don't want people sitting and collecting these enhanced unemployment benefits until they run out. Is that the right approach right now for this labor market?
Well, obviously, we need to start reopening in the parts of the country where it's entirely appropriate to begin to reopen, because there's just no good government substitute for a functioning economy. And I think the criticisms Gene makes of PPP are unfortunately seem apt, just, you know, anecdotal evidence. But I have a friend who has a real small business in New York City, employs five people, right? You know, the economy doesn't live or die based on whether his business survives or not. But he couldn't get in the first round of funding of PPP and slayed in the second round to get $11,000, which is 1 month's rent. And his business has been entirely shut down. Now, his landlord has cut him a deal where he only has to pay half of what he usually does. But still, you can see how easily, you know, this stretches on a little bit longer, he's going to blink out of business. And you multiply that by thousands and thousands of cases all around the country, and you see the sort of calamity we face. So I think the impulse to want to reopen is the correct one. It's just, as we discussed last week, unless the virus is truly in a downward trajectory in places where you are reopening, consumers aren't going to come out and spend regardless, no matter what the formal rules are. And Georgia has been most aggressive about reopening. There's a case, an article last weekend about a business in Georgia has a couple outlets where you throw hatchets and you drink beer. It's a bar where you throw hatchets. And the guy reopened and two people showed up. And it just goes to, people are willing to take risks to do certain things, to go to the grocery store, maybe to go back to the office. But when are you going to be willing to take on the risk to do something like that, an entirely discretionary activity, just something that's for fun? And again, that's probably a really small business, but when are people going to get on a plane to go to hotels again for a weekend? You know, they're not going to do it for a very long time. And that's just why, you know, hopes that this would be a so-called V-shaped recovery just seem totally forlorn.
Christine, what do you think about striking that balance? Because, I mean, you know, what I hear a lot from Democrats is that, you know, when you try to push people into going back to work, you're pushing them into unsafe situations. You're trying to shove them out, even when the epidemiological conditions may not make that appropriate. You're trying to use people's economic desperation to get them to work. And I certainly understand those arguments. The flip side, I think, is what Rich references there about that business that's just hanging on by a thread. The longer and longer this goes on, the fewer businesses that will be able to keep their doors open, be ready to reopen when the economy is ready for reopening. And that means those jobs won't be there at all at a point when people really are ready to go back to work. So how do you balance that, not pushing people back into the workforce at a time that is inappropriate, but also making sure that the businesses and the jobs will be there at the time that it is appropriate for them to go back to work?
One of the premises that we seem to have agreed on or talk around is that, you know, as Rich said, there's no substitute for the economy. If there's no economy, then people don't have money, then everything falls apart. And in this context, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. I think what we look for in this country, what we hope to see, is that people can stay safe, can stay fed, can stay housed without fear of dying from disease. And the way to do that is not necessarily to force them back into the office or to force them back into the hatchet-throwing bar, but to give them aid, to enhance unemployment benefits so that they can stay home and stay healthy, so that they can go back to work when they need to, so that they can feed their families or, you know, even attempt to go to the hospital if they're sick without feeling fear. I don't completely understand this obsession with, you know, making sure to bump people off unemployment rolls and bump people off benefits so that they're clawing desperately to go back to work once the business opens up. It seems inhumane to me, to be honest. And it seems to valorize the saving of business or the economy in the abstract over the actual lives and actual livings of the individual people who were forcing back to work.
Gene, what do you say to that? I mean, the way that the enhanced unemployment program is working in the CARES Act is not how you would normally design an unemployment insurance system. You wouldn't normally have unemployment benefits that are in many cases higher than what you make while you're working. You normally would not have broad eligibility for people who were not fired or laid off, who have jobs available to them if they are willing to go to work. Obviously, we're in very unusual circumstances that both make those policies more appropriate than usual. The law also had to be written very quickly and very simply, so that state unemployment offices, which are even already overwhelmed by this law, weren't even more overwhelmed by a law that would have been more technically complicated to implement. But how should policymakers be thinking about that going forward? These enhanced unemployment benefits, they're scheduled to run out at the end of July. Do they need to be designed in such a way? I mean, when should the government be in a position of basically telling people, now you have to go take that job that is available to you?
So the idea for the unemployment benefit, as was just said, was to try to make people whole. And the idea was, at a time where you're losing your job, where there's no issue of work incentives, you're being ordered to not go to work, it doesn't make sense to pay people, you know, the very low levels of unemployment benefit they normally get, which is 35 to 55% of their check. So the idea was, let's give people their full check. Let's give them 100% replacement. Turned out it was difficult to do. So they gave, as you say, for state unemployment offices. So they made it simpler and said $600. That was designed to give 100% replacement. I think people worrying that some people might be getting a little more than their paycheck is a little bit of a false worry at a time when you have, you know, 20, 25% unemployment. But I think the right solution going forward is not to say, let's do it to an arbitrary time. Let's do it tied to the health of the labor market. So what I would do is have something that said, let's give 100% wage replacement when we're at this high 20% level. And as the economy, you know, unemployment rate comes down, maybe that can go to 90% or 80%. That's still a large increase over our past unemployment benefits. But I think there's some reforms that are happening that should stay forever, such as that gig workers and other people who've been shut out of unemployment should be part of this for a long time to come. And, you know, secondly, I just say that there is about the dignity of what you bring people back to work. I think if you're doing it in a way that's careful, thoughtful, scientific, you need those workers because they're essential, but you're treating them as if they are essential and valued and dignified workers. You know, that's the right type of approach. I think when you see the president order meat workers to go back, when, you know, poultry workers are among the worst treated, have the highest injury levels, and then they're ordered back with the message that we're going to try to do sweeping liability protection for their employers instead of normal, reasonable care. That's kind of saying to people, we're treating you like a means to our ends. We're not really respecting your value. So it's both when we open, but also how we treat our workers and people as we do open.
I want to talk about that issue of essential workers, but I want to take a quick break first, and we'll come right back on that. I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Gene Sperling, former top economic advisor to Presidents Clinton and Obama. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist of the Washington Post. And our special guest is Gene Sperling, former chief economic advisor for Presidents Clinton and Obama. Before we went to break, Gene was talking about this issue of essential workers. And at this time that so many businesses have cut so many jobs, there are other businesses that are open, maybe even busier than usual, and having difficulties in their operations that include difficulties having appropriate levels of staffing. The obvious example there is meat packing plants, many of which have had to close because of coronavirus outbreaks. Gene referenced this effort where the president was purporting to order these plants to reopen, saying that we should have indemnification so that if workers do get sick at these businesses, that they can't sue their employers. So all these things basically trying to push people back into this work that is essential and maybe quite dangerous right now. There's another approach around this, which is that, you know, rather than using sticks, you can use carrots to get essential workers into work. You can give them hazard pay. This is a big idea that Democrats have been pushing. Also, Republican Senator Mitt Romney has a bill in this area that would have the federal government pick up most of the tab when employers give hazard pay to their workers who are working under difficult circumstances in this time. Rich, does that make sense to you? Should there be some sort of federal subsidy for hazard pay right now?
I think it's an interesting idea. I'm not sure I know exactly where I stand on it, but it just... we have to try a lot of different things, and we're going to have to be flexible. And I do think the level of unemployment benefits we have now is unsustainable in the medium term, because you do want people to have an incentive to come back. I do think businesses need some sort of liability protection that should stipulate that the businesses have to have necessary protections for workers. You know, writing that into legislation might be a little easier said than done, and some sort of subsidy for hazard pay makes sense, I think. But we're basically in a situation where we're just spending money hand over fist, and things that would be unimaginable, you know, 4 months ago become commonplace, and we spend, and then we're going to end up spending some more.
Christine, what do you make of the hazard pay discussion, and also sort of, you know, this collective realization of how essential certain of these categories are, certain of these categories of workers are, and you know, finding ways to enhance their pay? But it seems like, you know, this work is going to continue to be essential after we've gotten through the acute crisis. I think one question is, you know, whether this permanently changes the way that we think about these kinds of workers and the way that we compensate them.
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't it interesting what we're noticing now, that the workers that we deem essential, the ones who, you know, literally keep our lives running, who care for our elderly, care for our children, pack our food, clean our houses, are also the ones that we tend to pay the least and ignore. And then we're frustrated when, under, you know, extreme risk, they don't want to do these extremely hard and essential jobs for the terrible and limited pay that we were giving them previously. It's good that this has, you know, finally come to light and finally come to notice. And I do hope that we continue to think about it even after this crisis passes. To the question of carrots and sticks when it comes to unemployment benefits, I also want to encourage us to think a little bit harder about, you know, this idea that, well, we don't want to incentivize people to stay home, or we have to convince them to come out somehow. I think most people do not actually want to do nothing. Most Americans are not actually enjoying being locked down and sitting at home and not being able to do their jobs and feel like productive members of society. But at the same time, if, you know, you're asking them to do an incredibly hazardous or, you know, even just difficult job, and you're not willing to pay them a reasonable, a life-sustaining, a normal minimum wage or higher than minimum wage amount to do that job, then I think that means that you're not paying them enough. If you have to, you know, winkle someone out of their house to do a job, that means that you should pay them enough to make that job appealing and worthwhile for them. I think this crisis is underlining the fact that we haven't been paying people enough to do these jobs previously, and maybe we should catch up.
Gene, part of the question is who the you is in there in terms of who is not paying enough, whether it's the employer or whether it's a broader societal responsibility. Because a key part of the agenda to improve the living conditions of low-paid workers in the United States has been this effort to increase minimum wages at the state and local levels. You have discussions about mandates for things like paid sick leave and that sort of thing. And most of that conversation has been had over the last few years in the context of an increasingly tight labor market, where you can impose those sorts of restrictions that had no apparent effect reducing employment, and it flowed through as increases in pay and living standards for workers. Now, obviously, we've had an overnight shift in the labor market situation, the economic situation, and we may be coming out of this into a significantly weaker economy, where I'm wondering if we have to worry more about whether those sorts of things actually discourage job creation at a time when we do want to be creating jobs, and also how that will play out across different industries. I mean, if you look right now and you say, you know, essential workers who are keeping these businesses afloat, they should be paid more. If you are a grocery retailer and your sales are way up, you can probably afford to give out a pay increase. And a lot of those employers have been giving out pay increases. If you're a hospital system and you have low-paid cleaning workers and such whose work has become more hazardous and who deserve a pay increase, those hospital systems have had to cancel huge numbers of elective surgeries and are actually under significant financial stress and may not be so well positioned to give out those pay increases. So is this, when you look at the balance between mandates on employers to pay more and have better conditions versus subsidies where you have taxpayers as a whole pick up those improvements. Is that something where we need to be shifting more toward thinking about public payment, government payment, rather than employer mandates in this situation? Or do you think that we can come out of this and, you know, have a significant increase in the minimum wage and that will be fine for the employment situation?
I don't think there's any question we need both. And I just want to echo what Christine said. And actually, if you don't mind, I'll actually quote Martin Luther King. I mean, his famous speech at the 1968 Memphis sanitation worker strike was where he said all labor has dignity, was that someday our nation would realize that both the sanitation worker and the physician were essential to public health. This is that moment, and now there's the applause and the cheering and calling people heroes. But as Christine said, these jobs were always essential, and we have never offered them the level of dignity that they should have. And so there's a real question. Are we going to have like a short-term hazard pay type of thing? Or is this going to lead to a new social compact where we say all work should have a, not just a certain level of pay, but a capacity to care for your family? I mean, how does it feel to us as a country that these home and nursing aides who make 12 to 14 an hour, not just that, but that half of them couldn't take a paid sick day to take care of one of their own family members? So my view, Josh, to your question is you're going to need to do both. And I'll give you a perfect example. You know, yes, I think we need to pay those home health aides more. And I think we have to offer them better chances for skills and career advancement. But yes, lower moderate income families, that might make it harder for them to afford that. So I think you have to start with the view that all work should give people the ability to raise their families with dignity. And then you ask, what is that combination of mandates and government subsidy that works? My general feeling is that this movement to the $15 minimum wage has actually gone well. It has not had the negative job impacts. But so I feel pretty confident in the Fight for 15 movement. But I do think that you will have to have some levels of subsidy, and that might be to the hospital, or that might be to the person who's going to have to pay extra to have the type of home health aid they're going to need for a parent with dementia or for a child who's dealing with a disability.
Rich, what do you say to that? Do you see any persistent changes in the social compact that this crisis reveals that we need? I mean, for example, it certainly seems very important right now that people who feel sick should be able to not go to work lest they spread a disease to somebody else. Isn't that true even in normal times? Doesn't this show why we need paid sick leave for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, this is different circumstances because it's not as though you're, you know, spreading the common cold to someone. You're spreading a disease that's uniquely virulent. On wages, I've been skeptical and opposed to minimum wage increases for fear of the downside of squeezing people off the job ladder altogether. That's been less of a concern when unemployment was so low. And generally have favored, you know, a tight labor market. So doing all you can to stimulate our economy here and doing what you reasonably can to limit foreign workers coming in, which is those meatpacking plants. That's one of the ways that they can get away with paying as little as they do and the sort of conditions they do. They just constantly want to import more low-skilled workers. But the prospect of a tight labor market, which we had enjoyed for a couple of years there, is now just totally blown away. And we're not going to have one again for years.
Christine, what are you going to be looking for if we have a Democratic administration coming in next year? This will be the second of the last two Democratic presidents who will be coming in after a calamitous economic event, trying to rebuild the economy from where it is. What would you see as priorities for the protection of workers trying to get back into employment under Democratic rule?
I think that what we have just been talking about, programs that make it possible for workers and families to exist with dignity, to be able to take part in the economy, not under duress, but as free individuals, should be priorities. So, you know, just in this crisis, we are seeing that we just obviously need to have a clear policy of paid sick leave that applies to everyone, not just the privileged few who work in white-collar jobs in tech companies, for instance. Rich says that, you know, spreading COVID is different from, you know, spreading the common cold by coming to work sick. But actually, I don't want to, you know, be forced to come into work sick and spread the common cold either. I think that when people say are sick or have undergone bereavement, that, you know, all of us should be able to, you know, take the time that we need to take care of our families and to take care of ourselves. So I'd want to see a paid sick and medical leave policy in place. We also need to talk about childcare. Another big, huge hindrance on reopening the economy in any sense is the fact that you will send all of these people back to work, per se, and then their children will be doing what? Schools are closed. Even if schools are open, there are not enough daycare facilities. Daycare is incredibly expensive and eats up huge amounts of family income. If children are our futures and we want parents to be able to engage in public life, then we need to have something in place whereby they can take care of their children, whether that's subsidies for childcare, subsidies even for stay-at-home parents. But a comprehensive policy seen there would be incredibly important. And obviously, as we just discussed, we need to see real supports for workers. So, you know, not just companies, but attention paid to individuals. How will they pay their debts? Is there debt forgiveness or support in a new Democratic administration? Hospital bills, another thing that's keeping people afraid of going back to work, afraid of reopening the economy, is the fact that if they go to the hospital, they may be slapped with thousands upon thousands of dollars in bills. And this is not a crisis just of this moment. This is something that Americans have, you know, been in fear of for years now. That's an incredibly urgent problem for any Democratic administration to address. And we have been discussing that, Medicare for All proposals, or even, you know, something less radical, maybe, but that is something that I would want to see any administration discussing.
Jean, you have some direct experience trying to make policy in a White House in the aftermath of an economic calamity. So can you talk a little bit about what would be facing a President Joe Biden if he's coming in next January trying to dig us out from this? I mean, Christine had a number of ideas there that I think are very popular with Democrats. You've seen endorsed by a lot of people on the Democratic side, but you're going to have a huge fiscal hole that you're going to be digging out of. And you're also going to have to work with a Congress where, you know, maybe Democrats will have a majority in both chambers, but if they do, it'll be a narrow Senate majority. What is a realistic policymaking course there, trying to provide the economy and to provide workers in the economy the support they need within the constraints where any president would be operating?
I think the next Democratic president will focus on two main things. They will focus on, I think, what Christine and I have talked about, which is a new compact for workers. They'll obviously want to seize this moment And I don't think it's a big radical agenda. It's just the idea that if you work, you should be able to have a living wage. You should be able to have health care. You should be able to take time off for the birth of your child or the death of a parent. You know, just basic human values like that. And I think there'll be a stronger, you know, national emphasis there. Will a Democratic president be able to get it all done? I don't know. But I think there'll be a lot more power and momentum. And secondly, goes to an issue I think that's kind of been a subtext here, which is that not all the jobs are going to come back. And so, yes, we want to reopen safely in a way that doesn't backfire and bring back as many of those 25, 30 million jobs as we can. But some small businesses, unfortunately, will close forever. And some big businesses are going to do business differently forever after this. And so I think there will be momentum that you could see Republicans at least having a hard time resisting for a type of major jobs program. And I don't mean like public works. I mean with a purpose, like a building a green infrastructure program that, you know, isn't just hard hats and construction workers, but innovators and small businesses and science, technology, but in the interest of building jobs that maybe don't exist right now, but could help fill that gap, start to tighten the labor market. And I do think there will be a focus on the caring economy. And I think not just paying caregivers more, but actually giving them the chance to contribute and show that there can be higher returns in terms of how well our children learn or how much our parents can be taken care of without unnecessary cost and hospitalization.
Gene Sperling, former chief economic advisor for Presidents Clinton and Obama. Gene's new book is Economic Dignity. Gene, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Josh.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Most progressives have said that Joe Biden deserves the benefit of the doubt regarding the Tara Reid allegations and the evidence should be examined carefully. Fair enough. But then what's the rationale for opposing the Betsy DeVos reforms regarding how sexual assault and harassment cases are handled on college campuses? These new rules will bring a measure of basic due process to these proceedings, including that the accused should know what the accusation is and that both sides should have access to the evidence and show up at a hearing where both sides can be questioned. If fairness is right for Joe Biden, it's right for college students who aren't famous or politically powerful.
Christine Embo, what's on your mind?
So this week saw the death of Ahmaud Arbery brought to national attention. An upstanding young black man jogging in Georgia, hunted down and killed by two white men who would have persisted in impunity had not the shocking video leaked. I'd say it's unbelievable, but it's eminently believable because this is normal. In America, we assimilate black death into our daily lives. Black people dying disproportionately from COVID? Normal. Me worrying that I could be killed for walking, running, standing, going out at night, going out in the day, going inside, going outside, existing while black in America. It's normal. It's also exhausting that black people have to be the ones responsible for bringing these things up again and again, for relitigating our humanity, while even our most liberal allies can, you know, see these things, acknowledge injustice, feel sad, hashtag or something, and then set the feeling aside and move on to new topics, to more cheerful topics. This is something foundational about America and that I personally, as a black woman, have to sit with and experience every day because for me, there's no escaping it. And it's uncomfortable to keep thinking about, for sure. But I would actually encourage everyone to watch that video and to not turn away from this discomfort, to not continue to allow the loss of Black life to be normal. Because some of us literally can't turn away. And this sort of injustice isn't taking a break either.
For my rant, among the more than 20 million jobs lost between March and April were nearly a million jobs in government, most of those in local government, and a majority of the local government job losses in education. Now, it makes sense. Schools are closed all over the country. Governments, ordinarily, you would expect to have more financial wherewithal to withstand a crisis like this than private businesses, because governments have the power to tax. But state and local governments cannot run budget deficits like the federal government does, and that means that they are under tremendous pressure to cut spending, cut public services, cut payrolls. Right now, state and local governments are waiting. They're waiting to see what the federal government is going to do for them, using the federal government's power to borrow and spend, to give money to states so that they don't need to lay off workers en masse, so that there aren't way fewer teachers waiting for us when schools are finally ready to open, hopefully this fall. We really need federal support here, not just for the benefit of those state and local government workers, and not just for the benefit of people who depend on services from those workers, but for the economy as a whole. One of the things that we saw in the last economic crisis was huge drag on state and local government spending that formed drag through the whole economy. When you lay off those teachers, when you cut pay, when you cannot give pay increases that keep up with pay in the private sector, you end up cutting consumption in the economy. You end up cutting spending and cutting economic activity in the private sector because you starve the public sector. This is one of the key pieces that has been missing from the economic recovery legislation so far, and it needs to be a top priority if and when Congress gets back together and passes the next phase of coronavirus relief. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Christine Emba, Ken White, and Gene Sperling. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.